Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The persistent pandemic. As the U.S. approaches a sobering milestone, signs of American life fighting to get back to some version of normal. Then, when the caregivers need care, the impact of the pandemic on a critical healthcare role. And plasma's potential, using blood from COVID survivors to help build immunity among new patients and frontline healthcare workers.
This is literally a call to arms. I mean, literally arms, that we could, as a massive movement of survivors, do everything in our power to support the medical and scientific academic community.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The pace of COVID-19 deaths across the United States is slowing tonight, but the total is nearing a new threshold, 100,000. At the same time, the nation's reopening keeps moving ahead, led by a major American financial institution. Stephanie Tsai begins our coverage.
An opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange that may go down in history. Governor Andrew Cuomo did the honors wearing a mask, the now telltale symbol of the pandemic. With that, the trading floor partially reopened for the first time in 2 months. The normally buzzing space saw only a few brokers return in person, and most employees will continue to work remotely for now. Cuomo said the opening, after Memorial Day, marked a critical moment.
We're going to turn the page on COVID-19, and we're going to start focusing on reopening and how we reopen, and how smart we are in reopening.
But even as some New York suburbs entered the first phase of relaxed restrictions, Cuomo also highlighted data that low-income and minority communities are still experiencing double the infection rates of the rest of the city. In California, churches are starting to open their doors.
We reserve the right ourselves to determine the things that we should do that would be in the interest of our people.
After heated debate, the state laid out a plan this week to let individual counties decide when houses of worship should reopen. Meanwhile, at the White House today,
we need people that are going to be leading us in faith, and we're opening them up. And if I have to, I will override any governor that wants to play games. If they want to play games, that's okay, but we will win.
One top White House staffer, Katie Miller, Vice President Pence's press secretary, returned to work today after a series of negative COVID tests. She tested positive earlier this month, prompting the White House to mandate face masks for all staff. But even as the slow march toward normal progresses, there are new fears over meatpacking facilities where workers continue to get sick. The Washington Post reported today that there are 11,000 COVID-19 cases linked to three major meat producers, Tyson Foods, Smithfield Foods, and JBS. Each of those companies has taken steps to slow the spread of the virus. Still, plant closures and worker shortages have strained the nation's meat supply. Overseas in India, the number of new infections climbed for the seventh straight day. Cases have surged since the country lifted lockdown orders. Despite that, limited domestic air travel resumes there this week, with employees disinfecting bags and some travelers wearing conspicuous safety gear.
Coronavirus is very dangerous. We have to accept it, and we have to take all those measures which government is asking us to do.
In Russia today, authorities reported the highest daily death toll there yet. The country has the third highest number of infections in the world, but the government has reported a relatively low mortality rate. Russian officials have denied that they are deliberately underreporting COVID deaths. On the global economic front, French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled an $8.8 billion plan to save the hard-hit French auto industry. And in South America, the continent's largest air carrier, LATAM Airlines, filed for U.S. bankruptcy protection, citing a collapse in demand. That as a U.S. ban on foreign travelers from Brazil took effect today. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
As Wall Street welcomed back traders to the floor of the stock exchange today, traders welcomed the moment. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 530 points to close at 24,995. The Nasdaq rose 15 points, and the S&P 500 added 36. In the day's other news, the city of Minneapolis fired four police officers in the death of an unarmed black man last night. A bystander's video shows a white officer pressing his knee on the man's neck as he pleads that he cannot breathe. We'll take a closer look after the news summary. The government in Afghanistan began releasing 900 Taliban prisoners today, and it urged the militants to extend a three-day ceasefire. Dozens of inmates walked out of the Bagram jail near Kabul. The release was part of a deal that the U.S. signed with the Taliban back in February. Hong Kong's chief executive has dismissed fears that mainland China is moving to snuff out dissent. China's ceremonial legislature is considering a bill to rein in pro-democracy protests that rocked Hong Kong last year. But Carrie Lam said today it's for the greater good.
We are a very free society, so for the time being, people have this freedom to say whatever they want to say. But ultimately, what is to be provided in this piece of legislation is for all of us to see in order to be assured that Hong Kong's freedoms will be preserved.
The commander of the Chinese Army garrison in Hong Kong said today that his troops will firmly enforce Beijing's orders. Back in this country, the Pentagon's Deputy Inspector General Glenn Fine resigned weeks after he was removed as overseer of pandemic relief spending. In a brief statement, he praised the watchdog role of inspectors general. In recent weeks, President Trump has fired the IGs for the State Department and for the intelligence community. The Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, is now offering to host the party's national convention in August. The president has threatened to pull the event from Charlotte, North Carolina, over pandemic restrictions. He said today that he needs an answer within a week. Another Republican governor, Ron DeSantis of Florida, said today that he also is willing to host the convention. The White House announced that starting next year, Medicare copays for insulin will be capped at $35. Recipients who select drug plans with the new benefit could save about $450 a year. President Trump announced it as he looks to shore up support among seniors who have taken the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic. And Costa Rica is now the first Central American country to legalize same-sex marriage. The country's Supreme Court had ruled in 2018 that a ban on gay unions was unconstitutional. That ruling formally took effect today after the National Congress failed to pass a law addressing the issue. Still to come on the NewsHour, an unarmed black man dies after a Minneapolis police officer kneels on his neck. The impact of the coronavirus on the caregivers taking care of ailing loved ones. Sending astronauts back into space from the U.S. for the first time in nearly a decade. And much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
There is a protest in Minneapolis tonight following the death of an African-American man. He died after a police officer kneeled on his neck while apprehending him last night. Echoing the Eric Garner case from Staten Island, the man told the officer, "I can't breathe." The consequences have been building throughout the day. Amna Nawaz has a look at how the incident captured on video led to outrage in the Twin Cities area and wider. And a warning, this video has footage that may be hard for some people to watch.
The video shows George Floyd on the street, hands cuffed behind his back, pinned down by a police officer's knee on his neck. Floyd repeatedly says, "I can't breathe."
Please, please, I can't breathe.
Witnesses on the sidewalk are heard begging one officer to listen to Floyd.
Well, you got him down, man. Let him breathe, at least, man.
then imploring the second officer to intervene.
If you saw you call, were he doing okay?
Get back on the
call, were he doing okay?
Minutes into the video, one bystander alerts the police that Floyd is no longer moving.
Bro, he's not moving.
Floyd was taken by ambulance to Hennepin County Medical Center and pronounced dead. Minneapolis police said in a statement Monday night they were responding to a report of a forgery in progress and that Floyd physically resisted officers.
He should not have died.
This morning, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey addressed reporters after watching the video.
For 5 minutes, we watched as a white officer pressed his knee into the neck of a black man. For 5 minutes. When you hear someone calling for help, you are supposed to help. This officer failed in the most basic human sense.
By this afternoon, Mayor Frey announced four Minneapolis officers involved in Floyd's death had been fired.
Some reaction now to all of this from one of the area's leaders. Melvin Carter is the mayor of St. Paul, part of the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and he joins us now. Mayor Carter, thank you so much for being with us. That video is so hard for so many people to watch. Your heart just goes out to the friends and the family of George Floyd. When you first saw that video, you lead a community right next door. What was your reaction?
Exactly that, and thanks for having me on. We have a 10-minute video, just as Mayor Frey just said, of a man, George Floyd, having his neck pressed in from behind. He's defenseless, he's helpless, he's handcuffed the whole time. There really can't be any distractions on this, you know, as we traditionally see folks try to blame the victim or shame the victim, and there can't be any excuses. You know, there's no argument that there was a heat of the moment. There's no weapon or no sustained aggression. There's no argument the officer could have been acting in self-defense or what feared for his life. We just have a man, George Floyd, who should be still alive today.
Mayor Carter, it's sad to say the Twin Cities have been here before. You think back to the 2015 police shooting of Jamar Clark, the 2016 police shooting of Philando Castile. You cannot hear George Floyd say the words, "I can't breathe," and not think back to the 2014 death of Eric Garner after a New York City police officer put him in a chokehold. Each time there are protests, there's calls for justice. Months, sometimes years go by. What do you make of the reaction you've seen so far next door in Minneapolis to what happened?
I think you're exactly right. I mean, you can't pretend this is just a one-time standalone thing. I'll tell you what, in the Eric Garner video and so many of the videos that we've seen, and certainly in the one that we saw today, one of the most disturbing things to me is the other officers who stand around. If it's just one officer acting by himself, then somebody might be able to make the argument that he's a bad apple or that he's a rogue officer or something like that. Everyone knows the basic job of a police officer is to help when someone is being hurt. And so for three officers to stand there and not deem it in their job to intervene and stop this from happening right now to George Floyd speaks to an undeniable culture, a culture of violence, a culture of abuse that's somehow been normalized, that's been accepted, and that has to end right now.
As we mentioned, four police officers from Minneapolis have already been fired. Why do you think Mayor Frey reacted so swiftly?
I tell you, Mayor Frey is a good friend. He and I worked together closely on a number of things. I appreciated him making a very strong statement this morning, saying that this was unacceptable. It's unacceptable for being black in America to be a life sentence. I appreciate seeing them take strong action and fire these officers. I assume Mayor Frey watches this video like so many of us do and just can't live with it, can't sustain all of this. I tell you, I appreciate him giving voice to that. And I know it's a difficult situation for him because part of his job right now, too, is to make sure he doesn't do or say anything that'll jeopardize the city of Minneapolis or the Minneapolis Police Department's ability to hold these officers fully accountable.
You mentioned the police department. I should point out their first statement. Some parts of it were contradicted when the video surfaced and started becoming much more widely seen. There was no mention in the police statement of a knee on the neck or of George Floyd losing consciousness. It was classified as a medical incident. Those kinds of statements and stories can lead people to think the police are hiding something or they're not telling the full story. It leads to mistrust in the same communities they are sworn to protect. So as an elected official, how do you fix that?
You're so right, and it's such a big problem. Philando Castile was my children's lunch guy. And, you know, that incident didn't happen in St. Paul, and it wasn't the St. Paul Police Department. This morning, that video didn't happen in St. Paul, and it wasn't the St. Paul Police Department. And we've been working for years. We've got a fantastic police chief. We've got a great police department. My father's a retired St. Paul police officer, and we've worked for years to build the type of trust, to build the credibility, to engage community and community leaders. And when this happens, whether it's in Minneapolis or anywhere around the country, it sets us back years on that work that we've done to build trust. It puts every single officer in our country in a bad situation. And that's one of the most tragic things about this. We know that the process of building trust is never complete. It's never done. And so that just means we have to continue to double down on that work. I've spoken to my police chief this morning. He always talks about the bank of trust and the need to make deposits in that bank of trust before you ever have to make a withdrawal. And that's what we're focused on in St. Paul.
Mayor Carter, as we sit here, there are protests going on, obviously, in Minneapolis, people calling for justice. And as we sit here, there is the tragic American truth that nationwide, U.S. police disproportionately kill Black people in America. So when we're looking forward about what needs to happen next, tell me, as an elected official, what would you like to see happen now, specifically? So there's not just justice for Mr. Floyd's family, but we can make sure this doesn't keep happening.
I think you're absolutely right. And unfortunately, we've seen historically too many times that no one's held accountable for things like this. I can only pray that we have a legal system here in Minnesota, here in America, that's capable for holding these officers accountable for taking George Floyd's life in the way that they did. I don't think that we should send this to a grand jury. I'm looking to our Hennepin County attorney, Mike Freeman, to make a charging decision and to make it soon so that we can hold these officers accountable. If we can't or if we won't hold these officers accountable, then it'll just be another painful reminder and a mountain of evidence that tells our young, in particular, our young African-American men, that their lives are not valued in the same way as other people's lives are. That has to be unacceptable. I will tell you, I'm speaking up loud and clear about this every chance I can get to everyone who I can, but that's not surprising. I'm a young African-American man. We need everyone speaking up on this. We need our senior citizens. We need our white women. We need every member of our community who values life, who values humanity, who can look at a video like that and say, look, George Floyd, there's no reason he shouldn't be going home to his family today. We need to all be speaking up so all of our families hear this, all of our coworkers hear this, all of our elected officials, our judges, our police officers, that we are all speaking up and saying that's not the America that we want to live in.
That is Mayor Melvin Carter of St. Paul, Minnesota, joining us tonight. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Mayor.
The number of Americans who provide unpaid caregiving for their loved ones has been rising to now more than 50 million caregivers. The pandemic and the shutdowns have made their work that much harder, further isolating people in too many cases. We're going to begin with the voices of some of those who contacted us. There were hundreds who reached out. Here is some of what they told us, and a warning, this segment contains sensitive subject material, particularly for younger viewers.
My name is Deanna Ludwig, and I live in Port Washington, Wisconsin, and I'm 50 years old.
My name is Stephanie Campbell, and I live in Ellenwood, Georgia.
My name is Lydia Giordano. I'm 61 years old, and my son is 20 years old, and I live in Stamford, Connecticut.
My name is Hector Alvarado. I'm 37, and I live in San Jose, California.
My name is Karen Roderick. I'm 66 years old, and I live in Farmington, Minnesota, a suburb of the Twin Cities.
My name is Sean Moore. I live in Kansas City, Missouri, and I just turned the big 5-0 a few months ago.
I provide care for my 94-year-old father. This is a man who has lived through a couple of strokes and many heart attacks, but the COVID situation really throws him off. He absolutely does not want to die alone in a hospital. And so he restricts himself completely from seeing anyone else and having any other interaction other than with me.
So I live here with my grandma. I've taken care of her since I was a little kid. But about 3 years ago, she went into a dementia-related psychosis. And ever since then, she's required like round-the-clock care. I haven't had a break since the middle of March.
My caregiving began 5 years ago, actually, to my grandfather, who is 89. He has dementia, and he has had it now for going on 8 years.
Well, my husband is, he had a massive bilateral stroke about 25 years ago. He does feed himself. But other than that, he requires everything.
So I am a caregiver to my spouse, who is a 23-year Army veteran who completed 7 combat tours to Afghanistan. And for the most part with our caregiving, my husband has chronic PTSD and suicidality, as well as anxiety, major depression.
He has adrenal leukodystrophy, and that happened at the age of 7. Stevie stopped walking, talking, and went blind in 3 months. He had to get trached at 7 because he almost died, and he's had a trach since he's 7, and now he's 20. So constantly with this disease, you have to suction in order for them to breathe, to clear the airways.
With the pandemic, it was really getting extremely difficult before. And then any help that I was getting, whether it was someone coming in, that stopped.
Me having to remind him every day that there's a pandemic going on, it's repetitive to me, but not so much him, because again, he has dementia. So I have to make sure I tell him, Granddad, we're not going anywhere today. So for a minute, he'll take it and he'll try to understand the concept of we're staying at home just like everybody else. But within the next hour, he's saying, are we going somewhere today?
When they first started talking about the virus, I knew that I was going to like guard him like Fort Knox. I said, he can't go to respite unless I'm laying here dead. Do you know what I mean? Like, he will not go to a facility. I'll do this, whatever. So that's kind of changed over time. If they had an opening in a respite facility where there was some sort of like, we don't have any cases, but there's a chance, I'd be like, let's go.
His mental health has been declining. He's been in a depressive episode here the last several weeks. And he had a trigger Sunday morning. He left the house and he found himself purchasing a gun. So I called the police and we went into a situation of trying to find him, trying to track him down. But I told his therapist today and didn't cry, but I'm gonna cry with you. So I must be getting to the stage of reality, right, of what really could have happened.
This is one of the hardest jobs I've ever had in my entire life. The emotional toll it's taken on me has been indescribable at times.
And not getting enough sleep is also my other issue, which is very hard because as soon as the sun goes down, it's dark. I try to keep the house as bright as possible, but my thoughts in my head is about the coronavirus and my son. If it's going to be the one that takes him away from me, that's my biggest fear.
So powerful, and we thank each one of you for sharing your story with us. Let's talk more now about the challenges and what people need to know. Grace Whiting is the president and the CEO of the National Alliance for Caregiving, which just issued a report on the state of caregiving, along with AARP. Grace Whiting, thank you very much. These stories take your breath away. It's what these people are going through, I think most Americans don't realize.
I agree, Judy. And I, you know, thank you for showcasing those stories. I think to us, what is most surprising is that the pandemic has really removed the veneer, and now we can see what caregivers are going through. But so many millions of Americans, 53 million Americans, have been going through this on a day-to-day basis. And now we're thinking about it, but there's still so much more that needs to be done.
Talk about the toll this is taking, especially now during the pandemic, when these folks are isolated and they are not getting any of the outside help that they might have been getting before.
Caregivers are facing, even before the pandemic, when this study was conducted, mental health challenges, physical health challenges, and financial health challenges. So, you know, we know 1 out of 5 feel isolated. And we know not from the data, but from our community, that that's something that's gotten worse since the pandemic. Many don't have access to respite care even before the pandemic, you know, even though 40% of folks said that they would find it helpful to have access to respite care. And we see caregivers reporting that they don't take care of themselves. They don't have enough time for self-care, and that financial strain, nearly half saying that they had some kind of financial impact, like giving up savings or taking on debt or selling assets in order to cover the cost of care. Now, we don't know for sure from this research, but we suspect that those issues are only magnified by the pressures we're seeing during the pandemic.
And as we heard, what is it, the young man Hector Alvarado said, he taking care of his grandmother, he said he hadn't had a break since the middle of March, so over 2 months. And in some cases, they are facing situations that clearly cry out for professional help, for psychiatrists or someone who has direct experience with this kind of severe condition.
Absolutely. And I think one of the scariest things that families are now facing is when you look at the legislation that was passed following the pandemic and the congressional action, a lot of that legislation doesn't necessarily help caregivers in the type of situation, particularly if you're caring for someone who does not have COVID-19, you may not have job protection, and your sick days, the paid sick day extension, wouldn't count if you got COVID and then still needed time off work to care for someone else for any reason or for COVID if you used all your days. So there's a lot of gaps that I think people are feeling, and to not have had a break or to have a place to go to get the support you're talking about, I think puts new and uncertain strains on several families and threatens their own health and wellness and their ability to have a career.
And from your perspective, what is the most important thing that needs to be done now for these caregivers?
We need to address their mental health, their physical health, and their financial health. So that means expanding access to respite, making sure caregivers are included in care delivery, whether that's new telehealth that's available or conversations with providers. And the financial piece, making sure that the protections under COVID-19 for paid sick day and paid family leave, that those are extended to caregivers who may no longer have access to dependent care support because of all the shutdowns and the quarantines.
Grace Whiting, president of the National Alliance for Caregiving, thank you so much for helping us tell their story and shine a light on what these caregivers do and why we owe them so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy.
It's been nearly a decade since an American space crew last lifted off from U.S. soil in a spacecraft built here. That is expected to change tomorrow afternoon with the relaunch of manned spaceflight. But it will be very different, with the private sector leading the way as a partner with NASA. Miles O'Brien has our report. It's the latest in our series of reports on breakthroughs on the leading edge of science.
At the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, the stage is reset for NASA's next act in space. What's been envisioned for years is now becoming real, nearly 9 years after the last shuttle flew.
It's
It's probably a dream of every test pilot school student to have the opportunity to fly on a brand new spaceship, and I'm lucky enough to get that opportunity with my good friend here, Doug Hurley.
Veteran astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley will be sporting some stylish new spacesuits when they are strapped into a Dragon capsule sitting atop a Falcon 9 rocket, all dressed up for a new way to go. It is the first crewed mission to the International Space Station on a vehicle designed and built by California-based SpaceX, founded 18 years ago by Elon Musk.
In the history of space exploration, how big a deal is this launch, you think?
Well, I think it could be revolutionary.
That's former Space Shuttle Program Manager Wayne Hale.
If it works out the way that we all hope it does, and it starts a virtuous cycle of industry, providing competitive transportation to low Earth orbit, I think it will be great. But we don't know how it's going to turn out. It's an experiment.
Liftoff, the final liftoff of Atlantis.
The space shuttle and every piloted NASA spacecraft that preceded it was designed by civil servants and built by big aerospace companies under close supervision with lucrative cost-plus contracts.
Ignition, liftoff.
SpaceX signed a different sort of deal. It is providing a service to NASA, transportation to low Earth orbit for a fixed price. And the company retains ownership of its intellectual property.
This type of procurement works best when the company is going to have a market beyond what they're actually bidding for. So they are going to put in their own skin in the game because they recognize they're going to not only be able to service government requirement, but beyond that.
Lori Garver was deputy NASA administrator during the Obama administration, which canceled NASA's Constellation program.
Ignition and liftoff of Ares 1X.
It had already begun testing a suite of spacecraft built in the traditional manner. The cancellation spun up a buzzsaw of opposition from the contractors and allied politicians.
There were all kinds of behind the scenes difficulties, companies just really trying to block this innovative way of doing things. Unfortunately, a lot of people have come to NASA because they just want to build a rocket and they don't want someone else building it.
Panel will be seated, please.
Current and former astronauts weren't happy either. In 2010, Apollo legends Neil Armstrong and Gene Cernan, the first and last man to walk on the moon, testified in Congress against this new way of doing business.
I support the encouragement of newcomers toward their goal of lower cost access to space. But having cut my teeth in rockets more than 50 years ago, I am not confident.
Former NASA astronaut Garrett Reisman is an advisor to SpaceX.
And the biggest fear, especially in the astronaut office, was that it would be somewhat risky, that there'd be reckless decisions made in the name of innovation, and they just didn't trust this culture that was very different from the culture that they had grown up with at NASA.
Many at NASA were leery in the wake of early efforts to commercialize space by the cash-strapped Russians. They flew an inflatable Pepsi can, made Pizza Hut pies, and plugged a golf club with a shot off the space station. In 2001, California entrepreneur Dennis Tito paid the Russians $20 million for a trip to the space station on a Soyuz rocket. He was the first of seven well-heeled tourists to do the same. Mike Lopez Alegria is a former astronaut who led the association that represents commercial space companies. Why were astronauts skeptical?
It's a natural response. I mean, you know, most of us had dreamed about doing what we were doing for a long time and worked very hard to achieve it, gone through a lot of training, and to have somebody, you know, lay down some money and be able to join you and do the same thing and have the same experience is a little disheartening at first.
But SpaceX already had its nose in the NASA tent. In 2012, it began flying cargo to the space station using the Falcon 9 Dragon design. It's done that 21 times with one failure. And meanwhile, SpaceX rockets now dominate the commercial launch business, validating this public-private partnership. In all, Falcon 9 rockets have successfully flown to space more than 80 times.
Successful stage set.
You know, if NASA had done the exact same thing, it would have cost many times more.
Keith Cowing is editor of NASAWatch.com.
They've done this many times with the exact same rocket, And after one accident, they fixed a few things. And NASA's saying, yeah, it seems to be perfectly safe. And so now you have the ability to launch things in Falcon 9s that NASA may well now use in its trips back to the moon.
NASA is building the rocket at the center of the Artemis moon missions under a cost-plus contract with Boeing. But it is years late and billions over budget. Meanwhile, SpaceX is developing a Buck Rogers-like rocket called Starship that NASA is considering as a vehicle to take astronauts to and from the lunar surface. The lessons learned and the savings accrued in low Earth orbit are changing the way NASA thinks as it looks farther into space. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Vero Beach, Florida.
And you can watch the launch live tomorrow at 4:33 p.m. Eastern on our website, pbs.org/newshour. President Trump's messages to his more than 80 million Twitter followers often carry a lot of weight. For the first time, the company Twitter is putting a note on one of his tweets questioning the legitimacy of mail-in ballots, pointing users to where they can get more information. But it's the president's comments about the death of a congressional staffer 20 years ago that is raising eyebrows. Those tweets have not been given the same warning from Twitter. In a moment, Yamiche Alcindor will have a conversation about the way social media companies are dealing with fact versus fiction on their platforms. That conversation was recorded before this latest move by Twitter, but she begins with this report.
An angry president, a murder conspiracy theory, and a pained family.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Today, it's a letter from a widower that is calling attention to President Trump's open embrace of false theories. Last week, Timothy Kasutis wrote to the CEO of Twitter, urging him to delete tweets by President Trump that suggested his wife, Lori, was murdered. In the letter obtained by the New York Times, Kasutis says that, quote, conspiracy theorists, including most recently the President of the United States, continue to spread their bile and misinformation on the platform, disparaging the memory of his wife. Lori Kasutis died in 2001. President Trump has repeatedly spread the baseless idea that her former boss, current cable news host Joe Scarborough, might have something to do with her death. Spence, late today at the White House, totally the president doubled down.
Now, it's a very suspicious thing, and I hope somebody gets to the bottom of it.
Today, Scarborough, who has frequently criticized President Trump, said the claim compounds the family's grief.
Whether it's the president or whether it's people following the president, it is unspeakably cruel.
Timothy Kasutis wrote in his letter that Lori had an undiagnosed heart condition. She fell and hit her head on her desk at work and was found dead the next morning. He wrote that he had a simple request for Twitter. Please delete these tweets. President Trump's actions have been criticized by some Republicans, including Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois. He wrote, stop spreading it. Stop creating paranoia. It will destroy us.
President Trump's tweets raise questions about his own political calculations and the role and responsibility of social media companies and the media. Joining me to talk about all of this is Craig Silverman. He's the media editor at BuzzFeed News, and he's covered misinformation. Thanks so much, Craig, for being here. President Trump just took questions about this. He's doubling down on this conspiracy theory and saying that it's a very serious issue. Again, this is a baseless claim. What do you make of that, Craig?
I think it's kind of in character in that he does not apologize. He does not correct for things. And when he is pushed back on something, he tends to double down on it. And also, I think we have to recognize the dynamics here where he is kind of pushing this baseless claim into the news cycle. He is forcing media to cover it. He is forcing people to talk about it on Twitter and elsewhere. And when you talk about this kind of claim, there's less time to talk about other things. So in a sense, it's maybe not surprising that he's doubling down. He's not apologizing, but he's also trying to make this last for more news cycles and get more attention on this instead of other things that he may consider to be inconvenient for him.
In other words, this is working for the president, you think?
I think this is part of the dynamic that we've seen going on now, really since he started his campaign 5 years ago, where he goes extreme. He says completely outlandish, crazy things that you would think would discount and hurt anyone, but it just gets him more and more attention, brings more and more people to him. And in the end, he'll take any kind of attention he can get. And I think he's been very savvy about hacking the media to get that attention.
Now, the family of the young woman who died, who was a former staffer, of Joe Scarborough, they wrote a letter, the widower wrote a letter to Twitter asking that the company delete the president's tweet. What do you make of that letter and the fact that Twitter is not going to be deleting those tweets?
First of all, clearly, it's a really powerful letter. It's him speaking very personally about the suffering that he and his late wife's family have gone through and how they could be targeted with harassment, how this is bringing up the grieving process all over again. The second part of this is that, you know, Twitter has been extremely hands-off, extremely reticent to do anything in terms of restricting President Trump's behavior on the platform. And so as much as it's a very moving letter, I have to say I'm not surprised that Twitter has sort of held its line and said, you know, we're not going to remove these tweets because, you know, he's the president. What he says is newsworthy. And they've basically given him and to a certain extent other world leaders a different standard than pretty much everyone else on the platform.
I guess for the bigger picture here, do you think that conspiracy theories and misinformation that they're spreading more in the middle of this pandemic? And what are media companies to do, given the fact that if you cover them, you're giving light and energy to conspiracy theories?
I think we're absolutely seeing a really dangerous and concerning high watermark in terms of the spread of false and misleading information and conspiracy theories. And in a sense, that's always been the case during a pandemic. If you look through history, conspiracy theories and other things have always spread in this time. But of course, we have this digital accelerant here in our environment, and it is so quick and so fast, and things move and are organized to spread really, really quickly in this environment. In terms of the companies, I mean, I think it shows some of the weaknesses of their approach, where they are very reactive, where they kind of wait till things hit a certain tipping point. And then by then, you know, potentially thousands, hundreds of thousands or millions of people have already seen and interacted with something, whether it's, you know, a conspiracy about Bill Gates or whether it's a conspiracy about 5G wireless. It's just spreading and pulling a lot of people in. And I worry about that gravitational pull of grabbing more people to that conspiratorial point of view as a result of what's going on in the pandemic.
And you talk about a digital accelerant. In this case, you have world leaders, the president of the United States, using that digital accelerant. Do you see any sort of change in policy here?
So Twitter's response to the letter from the widower was that they are looking at introducing some new policy changes to address this. And they weren't any more specific than that. It is possible that Twitter is going to introduce and draw a new line in the sand. But I think they know that it's also kind of a dangerous thing for them to come back and say, okay, we've changed our mind. I don't think they're going to come back and delete Trump's tweets. I think they may set a new policy and try to draw that line in the sand. But to a certain extent, I mean, they've let Trump and to a certain extent others on the platform get away with so much that they're really trying to fix things once they've already gone really awry. And it's hard to imagine Twitter suddenly being able to not only come up with new rules, but to enforce them, because we have to remember that these platforms are so big that they can't actually monitor everything that's going on that's breaking their existing policies.
Well, thank you so much, Craig Silverman of BuzzFeed News. We appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
As researchers race to develop a coronavirus vaccine, attention is increasingly turning to a potential stopgap measure called convalescent plasma. As John Yang reports, this element of our blood is the focus of research in labs and hospitals and shows early signs of promise.
So here I am.
Donating plasma was the first thing professional photographer Diana Barrett wanted to do after she recovered from coronavirus in March.
If you look at the pictures of me doing it, I had an ear-to-ear grin throughout the entire thing. Yeah.
This is it. You're looking at my plasma.
Now she does it every week.
I mean, no disrespect to my family, but I would put the experience up along with, you know, getting married and having children. There are very few opportunities in a lifetime to literally save another person's life.
Barrett is one of a growing number of COVID-19 survivors giving what's called convalescent plasma. Plasma with coronavirus antibodies, the immune system's natural response to the infection. That's aiding researchers who are trying to find out whether those antibodies are effective in helping others fight the deadly disease.
Antibodies are one of the things your body produces naturally to fight bugs. They help kill the bugs a variety of ways and so-called neutralize the virus. And if people have a high viral load and they're in the midst of an infection, we can sort of jumpstart their immune response by giving antibodies we've harvested from others.
Dr. Michael Joyner of Minnesota's Mayo Clinic is helping coordinate a program at 2,000 sites across the country to harvest and distribute plasma.
It allows really almost any hospitalized patient to be eligible. So anybody who's at risk for developing severe disease, I think the consensus is based on past experience that earlier is better, and that you're going to struggle with individuals who've been in the ICU for a long, long time.
Trying convalescent plasma is not a new idea. It was used with success in the 1918 influenza epidemic.
Asian influenza spreads rapidly.
In more recent flu outbreaks.
Entire family at the same time.
And against infections like polio before vaccines were available. But it failed during the 2014 Ebola crisis.
Also, unten sind die Aries.
Around the world, researchers believe it's worthwhile to try.
Das Plasma.
You think you have to be objective and again, kind of balance between being a hopeful physician and a cautious scientist.
Experts at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore recently launched a clinical trial designed to introduce plasma to those at high risk of exposure, like frontline healthcare workers, to see if it helps prevent infection. Dr. Evan Block of the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine.
It would offer an intervention which is readily available and scalable. So I think, in some ways, the idea of prevention being better than cures is what really comes to the fore.
The process of giving plasma, called plasmapheresis, takes longer than blood donation and requires special equipment. A centrifuge separates the blood cells, which are returned to the donor, from the yellowish gold plasma. Some blood collection locations, like the New York Blood Center, which is where Diana Barrett donates, test the plasma for COVID-19 antibodies. But not every donation site is required to be as rigorous. Right now, plasma supply cannot meet demand. Enter the group Barrett founded, Survivor Corps.
This is literally a call to arms. I mean, literally arms, that we could, as a massive movement of survivors, we could do everything in our power to support the medical and scientific academic community in every study that they are doing, every clinical trial, donate our convalescent plasma, that we could literally be part of the solution. In a month, we have over 40,000 members, and I am proud to say that we are flooding these programs with volunteers.
In suburban Columbus, Ohio, it was volunteer donors who gave hope to the family of high school senior Nick Butler. He has an immune disorder, so his body could not fight the coronavirus when he got sick. Paul Butler is Nick's father.
He is not, like, his immune system's not like yours and mine. It does not have those antibodies, and the difference is his body doesn't produce them, so we actually inject them.
Nick was in Columbus's Nationwide Children's Hospital with his father by his side for 15 days, much of it in intensive care.
He lost 35 pounds, and he really hadn't eaten in 3 weeks, and his cough had gotten really violent. His heart had arrhythmias, it got enlarged, the kidneys numbers went sky high. His liver had issues, so each one of those brings in another team of doctors to kind of evaluate.
Doctors gave Nick a litany of drugs, including remdesivir, the antiviral medication that has since been given emergency FDA approval to treat COVID-19. But his condition worsened, and he was put on a ventilator.
They brought in, 10 or 12 doctors, nurses. They're bringing equipment in. They're wheeling stuff out. I mean, it was just crazy how fast all this happened. So they ask, if his heart stops beating while he's on this ventilator, what's your plan? And I'm like, we want to resuscitate him. We want to bring him back. And I'm like, can I call my wife and have this call? We got FaceTime and we talked to him and, basically told him we loved him. I'm sorry. And that was it.
While Nick clung to life, a family friend, Aaron Galloway, launched a social media search for convalescent plasma donors.
You are here. You are fighting for Nick, just like we are.
Galloway laid out the qualifications donors had to meet to be a match.
You have tested positive for COVID-19, and you are 14 days symptom-free.
Around the same time, college junior Paige Fallon was coming out of quarantine.
I have no idea what plasma is. I've never given blood in my life. Like, I have no idea what's going on. But I'm like, okay, I mean, I'm in quarantine. I'm bored. If I can help save someone's life, bonus.
Fallon had been on her study abroad in Italy, making stops all over Europe before it was clear just how bad the pandemic was.
Prague is where things kind of got a little iffy. I started having breathing problems, and I just felt like I was in a room full of dust.
Back home in Ohio, her coronavirus test was positive. But there was a silver lining. She could try to be a donor for Nick Butler, a total stranger. An email confirmed she was a perfect match.
Just receiving that email and like something positive coming out of something so negative in so many people's lives is like, it's a very cool thing to get to experience. And I'm lucky I even got to experience that. Like, how much more positive news can you get than the fact that you're going to help save somebody's life?
Her plasma donation made at an American Red Cross center became Nick's fourth transfusion. His doctors aren't sure whether it was the medications, the convalescent plasma, or both that ultimately pulled Nick through. He's now home, literally running on the road to recovery toward his next goal, starting college in the fall. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
As cities and states struggle to find the right balance between reopening and keeping people safe, the weight of those decisions falls squarely on small business owners. According to a new survey that the Census Bureau is taking weekly, almost half of small business owners say that the coronavirus is having a large negative impact on their business. Shops that are not considered essential have had to close. Anna Kehoe, owns a furniture and clothing store in Washington, D.C., and tonight she shares her humble opinion on determining when is the right time to open back up.
On March 15th, I began tumbling down the staircase of grief. We closed our shop for what we thought would be 2 weeks to flatten the curve. I was in denial. I didn't know we would lose our employees, that we would ask our landlord for help, that I would yell like a banshee at the bank because they ran out of funds before they reached our loan application. I bargained. If we paint, move fixtures, and deep clean the shop, we'd come back better than ever. Now, while states lift stay-at-home orders, I'm scared. We want to open, but at what cost? I'm now on the bottom step, known as acceptance, asking, why in the throes of a global pandemic does my business matter? There is no model that illustrates the intimate ways small businesses form the backbone of our communities. See, it happens when someone comes out of the dressing room, twirling like a child at their first recital. Finally, they have a dress that allows them to see themselves as they truly are. I can't believe how good this looks on me, they say. Or a gentleman of a certain age who comes by daily. He always reports which art exhibits are a must-see. He says our shop is a part of a ritual that keeps him healthy. These days, I wake up traumatized. I know it's not going back to normal. It's unlikely I will be able to rehire our staff. Best case scenario, it will be me, my husband, abbreviated hours, and a handful of customers. I'm not sure what happens when you go from full speed to full stop, then to puttering along. I don't have a job. I can work from home. I want to look my customer in the eye, shake their hand, even hug them. Walking to my shop, I pass shops whose owners I know. I say a prayer. See you on the other side. I have to figure out how to climb back up the steps of my shuttered shop, because there is nothing small about small business.
Anna Kehoe, we thank you, and we wish you and all the small business owners well. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.